I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Following the uprising in Baltimore in 2015, politicians, scholars, and activists pointed to issues of systemic racism and inequality as the cause of the unrest. Today, as we reflect on the 2 years since the uprising sparked by the death of Freddie Gray, we'll check in with two activists and community builders to talk about the work they're doing with young people in some of our most disadvantaged neighborhoods and the work we all must do if we are to achieve equity in our city. Erica Alston Buck is the CEO of Maryland Community Health Initiatives, which runs programs like the Kids Safe Zone in Sandtown, Winchester. Sarah Heminger is the CEO and co-founder of THREAD, a community building organization that matches young people with teams of adults to provide support. The lessons of Freddie Gray, right after these headlines. And good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you are with us on this Wednesday afternoon. Tomorrow marks the second anniversary of the 2015 uprising, the violence and protests that tore through the city following the funeral of Freddie Gray, a 25-year-old African-American man who suffered a fatal spinal injury while being arrested by Baltimore City Police. Much has happened since that fateful week, and many have expressed frustration that so much remains to happen to address the root causes of the unrest. Immediately following the violence, there was widespread agreement among politicians and community leaders that longstanding systemic racism and economic inequality were at the heart of the uprising. Millions of dollars poured into and out of the city's nonprofit sector, aimed at addressing the many issues that plague communities of color in particular. Governor Hogan promised funding to demolish vacant housing, and city leaders pledged resources for youth programs. We are reflecting on the anniversary of the uprising in several programs this week and next. On Monday, I spoke with Dr. Freeman Hrabowski, the president of UMBC and a longtime civil rights activist and advocate. That conversation, like all of our conversations here on Midday, is available on our website. Tomorrow, we'll look at the legal developments that have taken place during the last 2 years, from the failed prosecutions of the police officers involved in Freddie Gray's arrest to the lawsuit that those officers have filed against State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby and the consent decree between the Department of Justice and City Police. Our guests will be attorneys Edward Smith, David Jaros, and Deborah Hines. On Monday, I'll talk to local activists Davon Love of Leaders for a Beautiful Struggle and Ray Kelly from the No Boundaries Coalition about their work and their prescriptions for what we should be doing to solve some of the problems that have been stitched into the fabric of many neighborhoods for decades. And next Wednesday, we'll spend the hour with Baltimore Police Commissioner Kevin Davis. Today, we're checking in with two charismatic leaders of community-based organizations that work with children and teens to hear about the work that they've been doing as the immediacy of the uprising begins to fade in the minds of people who are not doing this work on a daily basis. Erica Alston Buck is the CEO of Maryland Community Health Initiatives, a nonprofit organization that runs several programs in the Penn North community, including the Kids Safe Zone and the Penn North Community Resource Center. Erica, it's good to see you.
Glad to be here.
Sarah Heminger is the chief executive officer and co-founder of THREAD. They're a community building organization that matches young people with teams of adults to provide reinforcement and support. Sarah, it's good to see you as well.
Good to see you too.
You are welcome to join our conversation. What do you think has happened in the 2 years since the death of Freddie Gray? What do you think should be happening as we move forward? 410-662-8780, our email address, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle if you want to drop us a tweet, at Midday Tom Hall. So, Erica, let me start with you. You are literally on the ground.
Literally.
Literally. At the place that many people point to as the epicenter of the uprising 2 years ago. What's different today than in April of 2015?
I'd say we're still standing. You know, after, you know, the masses disappeared, you know, the bullhorns and the shiny suits and all the cameras went away, we continued to do the work. And the work was simply to create a safe place for children in the community. We live in a city that needed a kids' safe zone. Like, we needed a zone where kids could be safe. outside of the uprising happening in 2015, it was also the year that we experienced 344 homicides. So we had the surge in violence and the uprising and the magnifying glass being put on this community, 72 square blocks. That's a huge footprint. And there were limited resources for children. So what has changed is there is still a safe place for them to go. We're still an out-of-school time program, so not after school. It's when school is not in session, we're there. We're still creating experiences and exposure for children who wouldn't see anything different otherwise. It's a community that lives in this four-block radius. These kids that see, hear, and feel the despair of this community all day, every day, and we've just created a window in their day where it's okay to be a kid, no adult-like responsibilities. We're not ducking and hiding. There's no gunshots. You know, in 2 years, I haven't gone to a funeral. I haven't visited a young person in prison. I've not bought diapers because a young person is a teen mom. I've not had any powwows to convince a kid to go back to school because they dropped out. So something's working.
Something is working. Yeah. What do you think is going on there? I mean, that's actually a very, very cheerful,
absolutely,
picture.
What's happened? I think the Kids Safe Zone, we created like the coolest house on the block. We didn't create a, you know, an institution. It's not a facility. Oh, youth led is not a catch word. Like, it's really a youth led drop in safe center for children. They run the place. There's this organized confusion that, I mean, there's 100 kids in the building and it's quiet. Like, that's bizarre. Children are reading reading is their passport to play video games. There aren't a bunch of rules posted on the walls. When we initially started, I thought we'd put up no fighting, no cursing, no kicking. But then as I went to print those signs, I thought, well, if they don't see this stuff, maybe they won't think to do it. So the only sign...
And that's sort of that's turned out to be the case.
And the only sign that's in the building is if you're caught running, you must complete an art project. So there's lots of kids painting and making cool pictures because they like to run.
Like to run? And it turns out they like to paint and create cool pictures.
Yeah, so. I mean, at 8 p.m., kids are leaving the Kids Safe Zone. So we created a place that not just the kids, but their parents. You know, your children are out on a school night until 8 p.m. Like, we give dinner every night at 5 p.m. The kids are doing yoga every night at 6 o'clock. You can come in and there's a room full of brown babies and downward dog. You know, that's how cool is that? And they wouldn't have that. So that's what we did. It's not some rigid, because we tried to do rigid because we got some funding and the funding required that we be rigid, but we gave that money back because we looked up and our kids weren't there because we were following the agenda of the foundation that gave the money. So another thing that's different is historically, and you said it in the opening, the uprising was the result of, you know, decades of being ignored, abandoned, and neglected. So our community got a voice, and they know how to use it. And it's been my job for 2 years to just instill in these children that they do have a voice, their voice is important, and someone's listening. And if you don't believe someone's listening, follow me, and I'll make sure you see the results of, you know, your cries. So I've just become this, you know, their megaphone. I'm not screaming, yelling, and, you know, stomping for my own personal agenda. I'm doing this to continue to provide the services that these kids need.
And that marginalization that those children and their parents and everyone they know has felt for all of their lives, what's the key then to attenuating, to getting rid of that marginalization? What's the key to establishing that voice, making that voice louder, prouder, and heard by the right people, whoever those may be?
It's funny. I'm leaving a doctor's appointment, and my therapist, a physical therapist, lives in Cockeysville, and we're talking about me coming here. And if you are not there on the ground, you have no idea what's really happening. If you're not engaged with an inner city Baltimore kid, you have no clue what they're really experiencing. It's nothing that you can learn over the air on a radio station or watch on TV. I, with being Black and born and raised in West Baltimore, But having gone and got my education and my career and moved away from the city, I was clueless as to the demise that our community has been left in. It is heartbreaking. There, not a day goes by that I am not standing in a room with my eyes full of tears, knowing that sometimes we're the only piece that these children have. There are families living in houses between two vacant houses. I went to a school assembly and a rat ran across the stage. They can't drink out of the water fountain. There's yellow crime tape. So for decades, people that don't look like them have come into the community, defined what their trauma is, defined what their problems are, created the solutions from a place that's not in. You know, you've got to be in here to get it. And it doesn't take a bunch of letters behind your name. It takes empathy. It takes compassion. It takes a level of resiliency that you've overcome the things that you want these children to overcome. So what is working for me in understanding that I didn't set out to create a program. You know, I set out to create a resource for brown children from a place that I understood what I needed as a brown child. That's it. So it's a level of empathy. And I'm not saying by no stretch that people that don't look like them can't help. Sarah doesn't look like us, but Sarah's helping. But she gets it. You've got to get it on a deeper level. And thinking that you get it and actually getting it are two very different things.
Aren't they ever?
So it's very hard to articulate why it works or what's working. But I think we both come from a place where we know that it really does take a village. And it is volunteers and people who have escaped, like I escaped, people who have escaped this madness and are courageous enough to come back and share their roadmap and help somebody else escape. That's what's happening.
Yeah. And Sarah, you do your work not just on the west side, but you actually started more on the east side, if I recall correctly. Talk about how your organization has evolved. You used to call it mentoring, and I know you like to avoid that word these days, and we can talk about that in a second. But you're working with kids sort of one at a time rather than 100 at a time in the same building, right? Your model for THREAD is a bit different.
Yeah, I mean, what we're trying to do, and I think what has changed a bit over the last couple years, is dispel this notion that if you have let's say you have a high school freshman who's 17 years old, who's failed three grades, who has four felony arrests, that has grown up in an area that's, you know, beset with drugs and violence, that they're a lost cause. And whether people will actually come out and say it, mm-hmm. that is what people think. They think that our kids are worthless. Mm-hmm. And if you know, this idea that if you haven't reached a child by the age of five, it's too late. You know, I know both as a neuroscientist and as someone who's spent the last decade getting to know our children that is just simply not true. So what we see in THREAD is these extraordinary individuals that are in oftentimes very distracting and challenging circumstances, but they are brilliant and beautiful, and they're not only capable, but they are our best shot as a city at producing a leadership pipeline for the future. So, you know, one of the things in our early years, given how we were founded and, you know, the fact that we lovingly joke my husband was the first THREAD kid, having parents that were both drug dealers and drug addicts and himself failing his first year of high school. And then because of a group of teachers who became an extended family, ended up at the Naval Academy, we were really conscious about telling the stories of our students because they're not our stories to tell. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think young people, it takes a certain level of like reflection and maturity to even know when you're ready to tell your own story. And what happened with the unrest is there was so much anger. And the anger had to do with, yes, the historic part of things, but the anger was that all of these people came in from what our kids viewed as the outside. And they brought bottled water and carrots and celery. And the problem is that as soon as like Geraldo had gone, like exactly like Eric was saying, like everybody went with them. Not everybody. Erica's still there, you know, but like, but it's a short list, actually, of like, if you make a list of what was there before and what's there now. And that caused a deep resentment, this feeling that like in the absence of real relationships, that there's an impermanence to the change that really needs to happen. And so that's when some of our, you know, our oldest students are now 27, 28 years old. They're alumni. They've been through their 10 years of Thread and then some. So they're older than I was when we started. They started coming to us and saying like, hey, look, we have something to say. We want to tell our story. We're ready to tell our story. And we have some really like concrete ideas on like how this needs to look different. And so that's changed a lot of things. I mean, the core programming of Thread is, you know, you enroll a student as a high school freshman. There's a group of up to 5 volunteers. We do everything that you would do for your own child. So pack lunches, rides to school, could be tutoring. It could be a college visit. But if you would do it for your own child, we do it for ours. And that's for a full 10 years. So all high school and 6 years after. And once they're in, they can't get out. So again, like, you have to build the trust. And part of the trust is like showing up when kids don't want you there and like repeatedly doing that. And they start to then question like, who are these crazy people that are like, won't leave me alone? Like, and then when they realize that the people doing it are unpaid, they're like, something's really wrong with these people. But you start to build trust. And so I think like part of what has changed is, in addition to that core programming, this last year, our students had an idea of, you know, what if everyone during the unrest who had swept in had just gotten the phone number of one other person they had never met and just agreed to talk to them once a month, like to your point about empathy and compassion, like how can you possibly have empathy or compassion if you don't have a conversation? Like you can't possibly understand what someone's going through. And even though as human beings, our experiences are dramatically different, the emotions that come from those experiences are things that we share, right? Mm-hmm. So we all have this, we've all had joy and isolation and sorrow. And like, so, you know, over the last year, it's been kind of our students taking the lead on figuring out how to bring together then 1,000 Baltimoreans in a dinner series, right? So that's something we never would have ever thought of doing prior to the unrest. And it was really initiated from the leadership of, I say our young people, but they're grown adults now.
You know, it's about attention and intention, it seems to me. You know, I mean, Kwame Opare, activist, educator, uses the phrase, and I've quoted him a million times on this show, unaffiliated benevolence. People, even if they feel like they have empathy, but they're helicoptering in and out, you know, they're serving on the foundation board, they're throwing some money at it, and then they think, oh, well, my job's done. They you know, shake their hands. So we got all sorts of stuff to talk about the stories of the people that both of you are working with. Erica Alston Buck, she's the CEO of Maryland Community Health Initiatives. They run programs like the Kids Safe Zone and the Penn North Community Resource Center. Penn North was, of course, the neighborhood at the epicenter of the violence and uprising that broke out 2 years ago tomorrow. Sarah Hemminger is the chief executive officer and co-founder of Thread. They're a community building organization that puts teams of adults together to support individual young people. We will have more with these two very gifted activists when we come back from a break. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. Last year, this date, April 26, fell on a Sunday. You might recall that the night before, some scattered instances of violence did break out during a mostly peaceful march from the west side of Baltimore to City Hall. The following day, Monday, April 27, 2015, Freddie Gray was put to rest. After his funeral, the streets of Baltimore saw the kind of violence that had not been seen since the riots in the city during the 1960s. Nearly 400 businesses were damaged or destroyed. Scores of civilians and police were injured. The National Guard was deployed to restore order. As the violence subsided and the streets cleared, people yearned for a return to quote-unquote normal. But in the 2 years since then, perhaps too much normal has been restored to neighborhoods like Sandtown Winchester. Perhaps the Gilmore Homes, where Freddie Gray was arrested, has in fact returned to the normal of neglect that created long-standing unacceptable living conditions for its residents. What should normal be for children who grow up in neighborhoods like Sandtown or Seton Hill with life expectancies that are 20 years less than kids born in more well-off parts of the city? Coming up tomorrow on Midday, we'll talk about what the new normal is in relation to law enforcement in light of the Department of Justice's conclusion last summer that the Baltimore police engaged in a pattern and practice of unconstitutional behavior in communities of color. We'll get a legal perspective from Ed Smith, Dave Jaros, and Debbie Hines. Next week, we'll talk with community organizers Davon Love and Ray Kelly, and next Wednesday, we'll spend the hour with Baltimore Police Commissioner Kevin Davis. If you're just joining us today, we're talking to two women who have devoted their lives to changing the paradigms for young people. Sarah Heminger is the CEO and co-founder of THRED. It's a community building organization that matches young people with a team of adults to provide reinforcement and support. And Erica Alston Buck, she's the CEO of Maryland Community Health Initiatives, a nonprofit organization that manages several service-based programs in the Penn North community, including the Kids Safe Zone and the Penn North Community Resource Center. You are welcome to join us with your take on what's been done since the uprising in 2015 and what remains to be done. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Let's go to the phones. James in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Erica Alston Buck and Sarah Heminger.
Good afternoon, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm an education advocate, and I've been advocating for kids for 22 years. One of the things, I take my grandson to school every morning, and one of the things that I've witnessed, and the lady brought it, it was so pertinent, is empathy. Children can feel empathy when people care about them, you know, when they know when people care about them. And unfortunately, we have a lot of children who actually attend public schools, and when they go into the school, they don't feel the people who are supposed to be adults care about them because they're rude to them and they expect them to be perfect. And a lot of these people can't relate to these children and understand them because they're not from Baltimore. They grew up shielded from all of the things that our children are not shielded from. So the empathy component is not in a lot of schools like it should be from administrators and from teachers that don't relate to our children. They expect them to be perfect. And I commend her for bringing that point of empathy to the forefront at the beginning, because if we don't have empathy for our children, who's going to have it?
Well, thank you for your call, James. I appreciate it. So, Erica Alston Buck, I mean, empathy and sort of sincerity and authenticity, this pertains to relationships between the police and communities. It pertains to relations between politicians and the political class and communities. It on the ground with teachers in schools and communities. I mean, it really it is an important. James makes a good point of how important it is. I wonder what we can do sort of, you know, as a society to elevate empathy.
It goes back to intention. Even with the Baltimore City Police Department, it was very important for me to help change the dynamics between the community and the police. Before all the community policing talk, before the decree, when we first started the Kids Safe Zone, I literally drove to Western District Police Station and sat in the lobby waiting to meet with the commander, insisting that the police officers of Western District, specifically Western, because those are the ones that were being accused of the crime, come in and hang out with our children. I thought it was important that you leave your badge at the door, but come in and play a game of Madden with a 14-year-old boy that lives in Sandtown. Because for me, that was changing who they were to each other. Now I'm just a kid kicking your butt on a video game. I'm not the next suspect. You know, I'm not guilty of anything. So we started there, and then we organized a community football game between the guys on the corner and the police officers. I mean, our guys were running a football in the rain in Timberland boots against the police. And our kids got to play in that game. So a couple of Fridays ago, we had an Easter egg hunt. I called Western District. Yeah, guys, come on out. Help the kids find the golden egg. So there's police officers and all these kids running across the field. And what has happened is it's back to empathy. Because now an officer gets a phone call and he recognizes the address. Because Tay-Tay lives there, you know?
So he knows the name,
yes,
too.
Yes, the response is different. These kids were only seeing police officers when they were coming to lock up their brother or their father or kicking a door in. But now police walk into our center and the kids scream their names. It's not officer this or officer that. It's RJ and Hassan. And because prior to the uprising, who does a kid call out for if they're not feeling safe or they need to be protected? It wasn't the police, because when we first started this initiative to change dynamics, police would walk into the building and the kids would yell 5-0 and run. And I thought, when the first time I saw that, or a little girl, a 5-year-old girl cowering in a corner, and the staff said, "What's wrong?" "Well, the police are in here." "Well, they're in here to come play with you guys." And for her to go from that little scared kid crying in a corner to being, you know, held by a police officer and giving the other ones high fives. They trick-or-treated at the police station. And I know that may sound trivial to some in the wake of, you know, police brutality, but it has to start somewhere. So that allows the officers to then empathize, because now they're just kids. So now you'll see the police officers come in whenever they feel like it, grab a group of kids, walk them across the street to the playground and push them in the swings or go down the sliding board with them. So it's that. So it's very important for me to help foster any new relationships or to find that little spark in everyone. We've all got it. But it just has to come from a level of understanding, like meet them where they are, really, not just a catchphrase, but meeting kids where they are and providing to them what you have from a human place, like not from some system, not from some career, job, position, but just from a place of being a person who cares.
It's midday. We're reflecting on the second anniversary of the death of Freddie Gray and the uprising that followed. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @midday. Tom Hall, Erica Alston Buck is here from the Maryland Community Health Initiative, Sarah Heminger from Thread. So, Sarah, let's talk about the paradigm that you're changing in your organization, which, as I mentioned earlier, tries to avoid the term mentor. you're trying to really change how people think about this relationship between young people and people who are helping them, who are generally speaking older than them. It's not a peer-to-peer thing that you're doing in Thread, generally speaking. A lot of folks point to mentoring as a really good thing. I'm on the board, and I'll be a full disclosure of Big Brothers Big Sisters of the Greater Chesapeake. I've been a mentor. I am a mentor to a young man who's now 26 years old. His birthday is tomorrow. Happy birthday, Paul. And a lot of folks say, you know, that really is a key. I mean, it's a good thing for any individual to have an adult in his or her life to help things along. But you've thought about it differently.
Yeah. So, I mean, when we started, I think the thing we had, Ryan and I had going for us, is that we knew that our children were not broken. What I think we failed to understand 13 years ago that we have a better understanding of now is that the system is broken. And so our original...
Yeah, the system, not the children.
The system, not the children, right? So I knew the children were not broken, but I didn't understand the implications. So my husband's white, and even though he grew up in really difficult circumstances, you know, I came from this understanding of telling our young people, well, if they just did what he did. So if you just work hard and you just check these boxes of high school graduation, college completion, like everything's just going to work out. And one of the hardest things for me to deal with just personally was when our first cohort of students became alumni and they had graduated, gone to college, graduated, gotten some of the master's degrees, and to see that it didn't work out without more intentionality on Thread's part in that way was heartbreaking and like a real sense of, oh my goodness, did I just lie to my kids for the last 10 years because I didn't understand fully what was going on.
And what do you mean by not working out? If a kid is matriculated through high school, gotten a college degree, even a graduate degree, I mean, what do you mean by not work out?
Yeah, so when we think about what does it take to be successful, so part of it is finding a job, right? 4% of people on average find jobs by looking online. How do most people find jobs? They find them by going through people they know.
The network.
But if they don't have a network and they don't have social capital and access to the network of people with the jobs, then it doesn't matter what degrees they have. I mean, it does, but it doesn't, right? Mm-hmm. It's not the full story. And so it started this like much deeper conversation in Thread about like, what is it we're actually trying to change? And what we're trying to change is this idea that there's a group of haves and a group of have-nots, a group of people who save and a group of people who are there to be saved, and wipe out that notion and really to delve deeper and say that like, we all need meaningful relationships. We all need to be understood. We all need to be seen, regardless of our race, our age, our gender, our religious preference. Like, that's what it means to be human. And so what we focus on is bringing people together in a way that allows everyone to be seen. So, you know, what transforms the lives of our volunteers is the young person seeing them. Right. And then that creates this virtuous feedback where then the student realizes, oh, my goodness, I've added so much value to this person's life. What do I mean by that? So you might pick a kid up for school. It's not just about showing up every day and driving them to school. It's when you get in the car, what are you talking about? Are you bugging them about academics or are you sharing with them what's going on in your life, the fight you just had with your significant other or what's going on at your job or what's going on with your health? Right. We all have stuff. And are you sharing it? And so as we started to like get deeper into this, that's where the word mentor became very loaded, because by definition, mentor is one person who has more experience or knowledge imparting it onto someone else with less experience or knowledge. And that is not how we view our children. We view it as an equal relationship where both parties are coming to the table with something to give and something to learn, right? And so when that like aha happened, you know, very unintentionally, I think our previous name was just reinforcing almost the racial construct that we're trying to destroy. And so after 10 years, that's how we ended up changing our name to Thread.
And Erica, this paradigm of human beings talking to each other around common joys, sorrows, challenges, successes and failures. This community of empathic people, empathetic people, where should they come from? Let's talk about this philanthropy piece of this, the white philanthropic community, the black philanthropic mm-hmm. community. We have things like One Baltimore, big, big fireworks and display announced by Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake on the 7th of May. The uprising started the 27th of mm-hmm. April. I mean, some of those fires were still burning the day she held that press conference with a very committed, smart guy, highly respected guy named Michael Cryer. Mm-hmm. And they're going to start this thing that's going to bring together all of these people, education, employment, minority and women-owned businesses, affordable housing, health, the works. They were going to somehow put all this stuff together. And I've talked about this now over the last several weeks on the show because it just drives me nuts that they raised, some estimates are 600,000, other estimates are closer to $1 million. They rented an office, they hired some people to work there, and then it went out of business. It just doesn't exist anymore. You were already, you know, you're doing stuff. Mm-hmm. Other people were, Sarah was doing stuff. People were doing stuff. And then there was this impulse, oh, we got to start a new thing to do stuff. What? Help me explain what's going on.
Wish I could. I'm still trying to figure out what's going on. I think the intention was good. Love Michael Cryer. Think he's a rock star. And meant well. They made the announcement on May 7th. I sent out the press release that the Kids Safe Zone was going to open on May 5th. We didn't open outdoors until June 1st, so you would think that we started when One Baltimore should be on fire and helping a lot. Met with One Baltimore, and One Baltimore for us provided, we went on like a field trip to go get some used laptops in Virginia. That was one Baltimore's contribution to the Kids Safe Zone. With conversations of, you know, more happening down the line. So it never happened.
Is the philanthropic community just sort of clueless about how to do this? What's at the bottom of this?
The foundation community is stuck in their ways. And stuck in their ways where no one's willing to take a risk. And it's money. It's money. And it doesn't make good business sense to take financial risk. So our problem has been that we don't fit into anybody's wheelhouse. No one funds a drop-in safe center for children because it never existed. So my battle is, okay, you've got to try it. Foundations have their agendas, their measurables that they're looking for, their outcomes. So foundations say, yes, apply for the grant. But we need measurables, we need outcomes, and they know what outcomes they want. And if we don't fit that, they can't support it. And I'm not knocking that, but someone needs to support it. So I've not received any traditional funding. And when my outcome is only from day one been, well, I want to keep Black kids alive in Sandtown.
Right.
Why isn't that an important enough outcome?
Put that on an Excel spreadsheet.
Exactly.
And submit
it
with a grant.
Because I can't, it doesn't work that way.
We got to take a break, but much more to talk about. Erica Alston Buck from the Maryland Community Health Initiative and Sarah Heminger from THRED. We will have more with these two terrific, terrific activists in our community. 410-662-8780 is where you can call. Midday at WYPR.org is where you can email. And at Midday Tom Hall is where you can tweet. Stick around. We will be right back. And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. We're reflecting on the second anniversary of the death of Freddie Gray and the uprising that happened subsequent to his funeral on the 27th of April in 2015, 2 years ago. Erica Alston Buck is the CEO of Maryland Community Health Initiative. She manages the Kids Safe Zone and the Penn North Community Resource Center on the West Side. Sarah Heminger is the Chief Executive Officer and co-founder of THRED. They're a community building organization that works across lines of race and class. You are welcome to join our conversation. 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org and our Twitter handle @midday. Tom Hall. Sarah, is it a matter of money? Is it a matter of public investment from the city, the state, the federal government? Is it a matter of philanthropic investment in ways that, you know, perhaps has not been done before? I mean, if someone came to you and said, here's $5 million, what would THRED look, how would that make THRED different? And how would that affect your work? And Erica, I'm going to put that same question to you. Somebody just drops, you know, this load of cash on you. What changes?
So, I mean, maybe one thing I'll just share.
And by the way, there's nobody promising to do that. Yeah. This is completely hypothetical.
That's caller number three, right?
Right. Yeah, right.
No, so as I've been traveling a lot, I just share this because I found it interesting. I've been hearing from a lot of individuals, foundations, and corporations outside of Baltimore that the way that they think about philanthropy is they divide organizations into small cap, which is 0 to 5 million, mid cap, which is 5 to 20 million, and large cap, which is 20 million and over in terms of their annual expense budgets. And they say that when you're under 5 million, you're not hitting a critical mass. So even if you have really strong outcomes and you're keeping all your kids alive, that the impact isn't yet optimized because of the lack of a critical mass. At large cap, you have a critical mass, but often your outcomes are diluted, so you're still not maximizing impact. The sweet spot, they say, is mid cap, between 5 and 20. And so I ask, okay, well, who are the great mid caps in Baltimore? Uh-huh. And they said, you guys are notorious for not having mid caps. You have a bunch of small organizations, and you can't seem to get those smaller organizations over the hump into the mid cap. And I said, well, what does that require? Please tell me. Right. And they're like, leadership. And they're like, you guys have that. Good programs and products. And they're like, you guys have that. And I said, well, what are we missing? They said, collaboration. And so a lot of what we've been focusing on at THRED is really thinking about how do we work together, which working together, again, requires trust organizationally. It requires empathy with those that you're working with in other institutions to, you know, sometimes you have a short-term loss in order to get the long-term win, mm-hmm. right, for heading in the same direction. So one example we've seen since the unrest was Tim Regan at Whiting Turner and Calvin Butler at BGE decided to set up a 8,000 square foot space at Mondawmin Mall, where now Thread is located with the Center for Urban Families, Baltimore
Joe
Core.
Joe Jones's thing. Uh-huh.
Right. Baltimore Core with Fagan Harris and Invested Impact with Rodney Foxworth. And what we've started doing is sharing in every way, helping each other fundraise, helping each other with staffing, helping each other with board recruitment, helping each other with back-end infrastructure, just helping each other and really working together. And I think that really is the key to not figuring out how to divvy up the pie more effectively, but instead, like, how do we grow the pie together? And not just financially, but in terms of the human capital. Because the thing that keeps me up at night, someone could bring me $5 million, and that would be incredibly helpful in us getting to our goal of reaching 3,000 students and 7,000 volunteers in Baltimore. But the thing that keeps me up at night is, will I actually have the staff team to execute and implement even if we had the money? And so that is where it's a pipeline strategy for us. We just brought on full-time two of our student alumni, right? So what is that transition strategy of leadership within our organization? And how do we think about that? Because money is one resource and one mm-hmm. very, very critical resource. But it's also the human capital and those sure. things often, you know, you can't hire people if you don't have money. Right. So yeah, and, they go and, hand in hand.
Yeah. And Erica, for you to scale mm-hmm. up is counterproductive. Right. I mean, you can't have a safe zone for 600 kids.
Right.
That's a town in Iowa. I mean, right. that's not a safe zone.
It's you know? Not. Exactly. Even our summer, we had 155 kids last summer. That's a lot of children.
Yeah.
I stood on the steps of the safe zone looking across the street. There's a playground, basketball court, and a field, and it was full. Like the whole, that's a lot of kids.
It is.
And for me, I think we've had this opportunity to change what fundraising looks like or change the dynamics of just the whole money piece. I literally run on donations. And as a result of that, I'm not crossing T's, dotting I's, and doing magic tricks for some reporting. I'm held accountable to the people all over the world that give their money. So our social media presence and our local media presence is very important, because if you donated 100 yoga mats, because that's what I posted on my Facebook page, we need 100 yoga mats and they arrive. We need 20 basketballs and tomorrow they're 20 basketballs. I have a guy in Texas who literally writes a check every month for $10,000. I went to him for the summer and I said, I need $50,000 for the summer. The next day I had a $50,000 check. I've got a little old lady who writes an $85,000 check each year.
But they're coming from Texas. They're coming from, so it's not just Baltimore.
Absolutely. Yeah, the checks aren't being written here. Mm-hmm. We get checks from around the world. $500,000 raised in 2 years through me opening envelopes every day. Mm. And then people,
what's your operating budget?
$285,000. Like, my salary doesn't come from that. That's our staff. It's keeping the door, $4,000 a month rent. It's our six staff members. Every single thing that I can get as a donation, we do.
Yeah. But far, far away from you know, what these folks are calling small cap.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's teeny weeny cap.
It's yeah. tiny.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
there's a person in Baltimore that can write that check every month, every year and be done and write it off. Mm-hmm. But that hasn't happened. So.
We got 1,000 folks who want to talk on the phone. We have just a few minutes left. Let's go to Tom in Baltimore. Welcome to Midday with Erica Austin Buck and Sarah Henniger.
My name is Tom. I live here in Baltimore. My son was number 199 after Freddie Gray. Mm-hmm. And when I was in court,
Tom,
a member of
so
his family
sorry.
Approached me and offered condolences. And at that point, it made me compassionate for that family, too. When people are victims of crime in Baltimore, their families suffer. But the perpetrator's families also suffer, too. We should think about them, and they need help, too. And moreover to that, I think that young people in stressed neighborhoods in Baltimore don't have the hope that I had when I was growing up. Mm-hmm. My hope is that I would be able to get a job to support myself. And I don't see where the average kid in a stressed neighborhood has that hope anymore. We need jobs in this city for people. We need people to have hope, to look forward to something. You know, we have to replace this economy we have in stressed neighborhoods with an economy based on where a person can go to work and get a, and have a job and get good money and support themselves. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Tom, and we are so sorry for your loss in 2015. Tracy in Baltimore, welcome to Midday. Thank you for your call.
Thank you for having me. I'm just so excited that this conversation is being had. I moved to Baltimore in 98, and when the unrest happened, I was really frightened, and I've been a volunteer at the Mediation Center since 2003, and so when, you know, just like Erica has been saying, like, the folks that have stayed in the work have been fortified by, you know, by what has happened over the last years, and I've seen people who have been doing the work for a long time just really getting grounded in the work, and so as a volunteer, Major Briscoe and the Director of Community Mediation invited me to help facilitate conversation with No Boundaries and youth from Yo Baltimore with police officers from Western District. And that has just really, because at the time I was just like, I might need to leave. I have 7 grandkids and maybe I need to leave. And so like being part of that conversation has just like really rejuvenated me as a Baltimore resident and,
well, Tracy,
and made
thank
me feel
you.
Hopeful again.
Thank you so much for your call. We are running out of time, so I'm going to have to hurry things along. But just as we finish up, we literally have like 30 seconds left. Erica, I mean, as you look ahead, are you sanguine? Are you optimistic that you know, you can keep doing this work and that things really will get better? You're painting a fairly optimistic picture so far.
Absolutely. Back to Tom, it's about hope. I think my job each day is to restore some hope in a community that has been hopeless for so long.
And Sarah, your goal, 3,000 kids, 7,000 mentors, you're going to get there? Or sorry, didn't mean to do that. Shame on me. Minus 10 points for Tom. But it's close.
I don't know if we'll get there, but we're sure going to try. And the people that are going to be leading us there are our alumni. Mm-hmm. And that's what's exciting. It's exciting that I'm now raising my daughter, Evie, with, you know, Judy, who's an alumni, her daughter, Linda. They play together all the time and are starting school together. Like,
well, that's... God bless. God bless to all of you. Thank you both for all the work you're doing and for spending your afternoon with us today. Erica Alston-Buck from the Maryland Community Health Initiative, Sarah Heminger from THREAD. They are working across lines of race and class to build community and support. We've got information about programs like the Kids Safe Zone, the Penn North Community Center, and THREAD on our website, wipr.org/midday. That's up for it for us today on Midday. Coming up on the program tomorrow, we're going to talk about the legal implications that have come down since the death of Freddie Gray and the uprising. Then on Monday, we'll speak with activists Davon Love and Ray Kelly. And on Wednesday, I'll speak with Police Commissioner Kevin Davis. That's coming up this week and next here on Midday as we reflect on the 2-year anniversary of the uprising in April of 2015. Lunch today was provided by the Baltimore Chef Shop on the Avenue in Hamden. They offer a variety of private events and cooking classes for kids and adults, including baking and international cuisines. Tomorrow evening, they're offering a Mediterranean menu class. We've got more on the web at BaltimoreChefShop.com. Let me also remind you that on Friday, we're going to be broadcasting Midday at the Movies live from the Stavros Niarchos Parkway Theater. That's the new home of the Maryland Film Festival. And if you'd like to join us, come to WIPR.org to reserve your free ticket. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Oh, picket lines and picket signs. Punish me.